This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network podcast. I'm Roberto Mazza, the host of the Jerusalem Unplugged podcast. And today for the Middle Eastern Studies series, my guest is Dylan Baun. Dylan is currently at the University of Alabama, Huntsville, and recently published Winning Lebanon, Youth Politics, Populism, and the Production of Sectarian Violence between 1920 and 1958, published by Cambridge University Press. And I just want to mention also that the book will appear in a paperback edition coming in October. The book is very much a great and I would say a new study of Lebanon, basically from the end of a mandatory period up to the civil war of 1958, but relying on something different, youth and popular organizations. We will talk with our guest today about the question of studying youth and childhood up to a point, obviously, since he's focusing more on, let's say, the teenagers' years of individuals under review. But I'd be curious to ask him later about why in Middle Eastern studies we don't focus much on this particular category of people. But before all of this, Dylan, welcome.
Thank you, Roberto. Thanks for having me.
So I guess I want to start with the usual question, see if you can tell us a little bit more about yourself, your background, and more importantly, the origins of the book.
Yeah. So as long as I can remember, I loved history, all different types of history. And I think my first engagement with the Middle East and Arab history in particular was during my undergraduate years. I studied abroad to Greece and took a trip to Cairo. And just sort of fell in love with the Arab world. I was just sort of blown away by the scale, size, and all these new things for me as, just largely growing up in the United States. So at that point, I sort of had my focus, the Middle East, and I went to graduate school for Middle Eastern Studies, focusing on history at the University of Arizona. I fell into Lebanon, like many, as an outsider, found it as sort of a fascinating country, fascinating case, and not too bad of a place to go visit for research. When I was doing dissertation fieldwork research, and my dissertation was on the period in Lebanon from the mandate period, as you mentioned, the colonial period, all the way up to the start of the second or later civil war of 1975. And I was focusing on what I was referring to at the time as militias and political parties. But I realized, looking into the archives, that these groups, especially in an earlier time period, saw themselves differently, not just as political parties and definitely not as militias. And the quote that really tipped me off to the origins of this book was the quote that I start the book with. It comes from one of the youth organizations that I work with called the Kataeb. And the phrase in English is, "With the youth by our side, there is no way we won't succeed." That really spoke to me that in this group, this was actually a beginning of a speech that this phrase was used. I think it was in 1940, and that they were targeting young people as potential members of their organizations, but talking about youth as the drivers of the future in ways that I've seen in other cases, whether, for example, Mao Zedong talking about the youth as the sort of bedrock of the Communist Revolution in China. So it really got me thinking about that angle of youth. And at the time, I was working on dissertation fieldwork. It was a little bit too late to kind of infuse the dissertation with that, but it came to focus. And after that, I couldn't unsee the fact that these groups saw themselves, especially in earlier years, first and foremost as youth organizations or youth-centric organizations. So that ended up being the impetus for the book.
Fantastic. And then as a follow-up, I really want to ask you something about the main argument of the book. And if you can give us a sense of what is it trying to achieve and also the sources that you have used.
Yeah. So the main argument of the book, it's fairly simple. I like starting with a simple argument and kind of building out from there as a writer. That argument is that these youth organizations that I'm focusing on, they matter to the history of modern Lebanon, and that they matter to the history of the broader Arab world. As you mentioned in the introduction, sometimes these groups and the young people within them and young people more at large are written out of historical narratives. And that was largely the case until very recently in Lebanon. So my goal more broadly is to write these historical actors into the historical narrative of Lebanon. But then the question is, okay, how do they matter? And that's where the argument gets a little bit more complex. I argue that they matter and that they were sort of the first organizations to adopt something that I refer to as populist politics or popular politics. They were the first sort of populist organizations in Lebanon and part of a broader movement in the Arab world during that time period. Second, they were the first to sort of broaden the concept of who were young people. We can talk about that more later, but young people was often thought of, especially earlier, the youth, the Shabab, as male, middle class, and predominantly educated. And these organizations, they largely did change that conception and broaden the base. And third, I argue that these groups really matter in what I refer to in the subtitle of the book, the production of sectarian violence. These weren't the first organizations to be referred to by historians as sectarian, and they weren't the first ones in Lebanon to practice sectarian politics. That's not what I'm arguing. But what is distinct about 1958 and their participation is that youth, as an idea and a term, becomes linked to sectarianism, and that potentially young people are prone to sectarian violence. This was an accusation that came up in 1958 in the war, and something that I would argue you see in later episodes of sectarian violence, as sort of described by journalists, historians, and whatnot, that young people are either prone to violence or prone to a specific type of violence. So that is the general argument, and how I came to that argument were sources focusing on these youth-centric organizations. I focus on seven in total. I refer to the sources as their cultural production. So my basic research question is, what are the types of sources that can tell us something about the culture, organization, rituals of these organizations? And what we're really benefited by Lebanon in this time period is the diversity of print media and print culture. All of these organizations, besides one, had their own newspaper at one point. And I'm not reading these newspapers as an historian for events only or events that they're involved in, but how do they construct their identity, their culture, their ideal membership through these newspapers? So that's the main source work, and that definitely kept me busy for most of the research. But also interested in pictures, songs, ephemera, anything these organizations, at least that are still around today, will provide me, that can tell me something about how they saw themselves and how they saw themselves being young people driving the future of their country.
There's a lot of stuff to unpack here. And I have a series of questions very much, you know, we try to keep it short, but about sort of a methodological implant of your work and also the terminology that you have used. But let me ask first about the question of youth. Youth matters. And as we both know, you know, looking at sources from different contexts, political parties in the Middle East cared about youth. They dedicated articles, they created organizations and also educational programs, particularly through the 1920s with the creation of various mandates throughout the region. But it is only a recent addition to the list of topics that has been explored by historians of the Middle East. And I was wondering if you have an idea why childhood, youth have been neglected or underestimated.
Yeah, that's a great question. Actually, one I wish I would have taken up in the book more so. You know, I sort of say it is neglected, but don't really get into to the why. So I think the why is multifaceted. And I think it reflects trends that we see in other areas and fields of history. I think one is first, especially in English language sources and secondary literature, the grand narratives, right? Empiricism as a sort of method of general history up until, let's say, the cultural turn, 1970s, 1980s. So accordingly, I feel like many of the studies that were on Lebanon were on the founders. Bishar al-Khoury, for example, Michel Shiha, Riyad al-Sur, these elites, that they are the focus. And as I just mentioned, they're the men, right? The men that make history. And I think that was largely, especially when I think of some of the foundational but great works on Lebanon, the work of Kamal Salibi, Philip Hitti, Stephen Longridge Helmsley, who wrote a great book on the Mandate. These were the individuals that they focused on. And if young people or these organizations were talked about in those books, it was often pejorative, that they didn't matter, or that they were just sort of sectarian organizations and that they were controlled by elites. And I think my book shows that it's a little bit more complicated than that. So that's definitely one aspect. I think also, and you kind of set it up well with your lead up to the question there, starting with sort of political parties and their overtures to youth, which of course my book is largely about. But if we start, and I found this in the literature, if we start with that aspect, we're focusing more on the political party and the youth aspect is sort of marginal. And hence, you know, there's a great book by Michel Suleiman on political parties and political culture in Lebanon from the 60s. It's one of my favorite books from that era. But it focuses on the youth aspect as marginal, an extension of these political parties. But like I mentioned with that quote in the beginning, if we're searching and asking different questions about this category, which is a new category to study, youth, we might see different things than just the political party. I think also a lot of historians and social scientists of Lebanon, the Middle East, even if they're not Marxists themselves, I think they're inspired by Marxist methodology. And I think accordingly, this idea that youth doesn't have that much of a relationship to capital, the elites do, especially in a place like Lebanon. So I think that's another reason as well. They're not seen as mattering in that particular way. But yeah, I think you know, with the cultural turn and other things more recently, there's this question of not only do women matter, of course, do children matter, of course, but do young people as a category, as it's constructed at the time, do they matter? And there's some great works out there for those who are interested in the history of the Middle East that cover this. I'm thinking of Nazan Maksudyan's work on the Ottoman Empire. I'm thinking of Heidi Morrison's work on Egypt. She also has a book coming out on Palestine, which is going to be about young people. And also the work of Wilson Jacob and Lucy Rizova on Egypt during the Mandate period. So it is a new trend, and I'm really happy to be a part of it.
Great, fascinating. And you're right. I mean, it's a growing field, and I feel like it's about time actually to start talking about these categories that always been some sort of cornered, and they've been written out of the history of these emerging countries. Even because then youth, they became the adults of their future. And so it's important that we get to understand in which context they experienced those years and how they translated that experience into their political choices or social, economic, and so forth. I have a couple of very quick questions. One is about the terminology I mentioned earlier. You're talking about populism, and you define the organizations that you discuss in the book as populist. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. One aspect is sort of specific to literature on the region, and then one's a little bit more theoretical. So there is some great work on popular politics in the modern Middle East. I'm thinking of the work of Jim Galvin, Orit Bashkin. There's so many great works. And some of them discuss this aspect a little bit, but there's this Arabic term, Shabia, which literally means popular, and it's what many of these organizations used when they talked about themselves. So that's the first reason I use this idea of popular organizations, populism, and populist, because the organizations themselves believed that they were popular, and meaning that they were large and that they were non-elite. Right. And I think more broadly, that leads into, a question of sort of what is populism to these organizations, to different shapes and forms. They were anti-elite. They were their anti-elite, or some of their founders were new elites, or like sort of the new effendia, the new middle class sort of coming out of the mandate period. So, but they weren't the individuals who held all of the wealth, power, political power in the country. So populist in that sense, anti-elite. In different shapes and forms, they were all anti-imperial and anti-state. Populism as not being something you particularly are, but what you define yourself against. And discursively, I think this plays the biggest role. When you look at these organizations, newspapers, the rhetoric, they are often talking about being, drawing their organization against these things. So we are not elite, we are Shabia. We are not, we are not of the state, of the government. We are popular. We are of the people, the Shab. So that's how I use the term and the concept in the book.
And I'm also curious about the term sectarian. In your book, you make a good point of staying away from this idea of sectarian violence. Obviously, you talk about it at some point. But I was wondering, what is the role of sectarianism and violence in your narrative?
Yeah, I'm glad you made that clarification. Often when these, and this goes back to your literature question, when these groups are talked about or young people are talked about, it is that they are sectarian or prone to violence, as if it's something that is inside of them, that they are, breathing out or living out, something that is born in them. And I categorically disagree with that. I see sectarianism as a foundation violence more broadly as I put in the title of my book, productive or production, generative. Okay. So if sectarianism is an identity-based politics, of course it can be structural. How do laws, government structure, things dealing with citizenship, Maya McDashi's new book is great here in sort of opening up some new questions about sectarianism. How does that shape the actors that I'm talking about, but also how do they, through their populism, through their beliefs, through their practices, how did they shape this thing that we called identity-based politics, or specifically in the Middle East? And, I'm starting to get away from the term a little bit, even though it is in the title of my book, sectarianism. So focusing on that aspects, but violence as well. It does play a role. I do not think that these groups should be or are well understood as being defined by violence. But violence did play a role in their organizational cultures. I can talk about that a little bit later. And as we know, in 1958, they do participate in a war that is sometimes very much forgotten, but I find very important. So that is the role that, the way that I think about sectarianism, how these groups sort of played a role in producing it, but also their engagement in violence.
And one last question before we start delving into the chapters.
Great.
Why 1958 as the end line of your book? And can you speak a little bit about the chronology of your work?
Yeah. So 1958 as an endpoint was a late sort of late. I came to that late. As I was mentioning, my dissertation went into the 1970s, but I decided to cap the book at 58 for a couple reasons. One is literature-based. There is a lot on the 1958 war, but not much that actually puts it in broader perspective of events and time periods that come before it. So I wanted 58 to be the culmination, but looking backward. Second, there's in terms of the literature aspects, there's just a lot of work on the Lebanese Civil War of 1975 to 1990. I still think that there's new things to explore there. And actually, my next book is going to be dealing with the 60s and the 1970s in Lebanon and elsewhere. But I thought that it was important to kind of focus on 58 for its own right, because as I mentioned earlier, it's forgotten so often as something that was sort of a blip in the radar, but I see it as much more sort of generative. And so that's why the book ends in 1958. And in terms of the chronology, so a lot of these organizations and groups, these youth-centric groups, that were talking about young people, saw themselves as drivers of the future. They were founded largely around the First World War, either a little bit before or after, but also largely during the French Mandate period, the French colonial period. So that's where I start, in the 1920s, 1930s, where the majority of these groups, I think at least five of them, maybe four, a mass majority of them came of age, as organizationally speaking, under the French Mandate period. So that's the focus. And the French left in around 1943. That was the official date, but up until 1946. And then I focus on the early independence period. And this is a very important period for these groups, because this is sort of where, depending on the organization, they're transforming from seeing themselves as predominantly youth social movements to potentially, with the independence of their country, participating in parliamentary politics and party politics and becoming more political parties. That all comes to a head in 1958. And I think we'll talk more about that later.
So let me start with a question related to chapter one, which I want to mention to the listeners and the readers of the book. This is a foundational chapter, one that has to be read carefully, because you provide the details of the organizations under review. And I was wondering if you can give us a brief sense about the organizations and also perhaps about the people that belong to the organization.
Yeah, it is foundational, and it's pretty long too. But I do think I think it's an important one. I think it sets the stage, of course, organizationally speaking. But I do have to say I like the choice I made. So the choice that I made was basically to focus on a different aspect that connects all of these groups, but use or take one group to explore that. So, for example, the Lebanese People's Party, which eventually was referred to as the or became the Lebanese Communist Party, they were the first organization founded, early 1920s. And for that organization, I focus on populism. Like, what role did they play in creating this new sort of aspect of popular politics that I refer to as populism or Shabia, and then sort of its afterlife from there. And I kind of follow that organization to organization. I won't talk about all of them, but how did young people learn about these groups? Okay, so I focus on the newspapers, and I use one group to focus on the newspapers. How did they join the organization? Which I think is really, really important in sort of belonging and community belonging. So I use one organization to take that up. And it goes on and on through talking about the popular culture of the organizations when they were founded, sort of the institutional mechanisms of the organization. Funding, which I think is important. I'm not an economic historian myself. I more see myself as a cultural historian, but the money does matter to a certain extent. And also talk about networks, because these organizations weren't insular. They had relationships to different religious, charitable, and social organizations, but sometimes universities as well. So I do that in all seven groups. So we learn a little bit about each organization, their founders, their ideas, the people that are in them, but also certain aspects that really unite all the organizations. All of them had a popular culture. All of them had chants. All of them had rituals, for example. All of them had membership. Membership rituals. So I take a particular group to discuss that. Now, in terms of who were in these organizations, especially in the early days, like who are the young people that are in it? This is something I actually didn't mention earlier. I think sometimes scholars didn't focus on youth until recently. Is like how do we find them in the source work, right? So I think there are some organizations that in their newspaper dedicate more time, information to their young members, so I can write more about those individuals in certain cases. In others, it's a little bit more demographic, sort of where they're from, what age, what professions, et cetera, less sort of individual stories. But generally speaking, especially in the early days, young people in these organizations were, like you mentioned earlier, teenage, college age, university age, around that age. But specifically middle class, university students, high school students, working class students, not always working class students, working class individuals, but also early, almost exclusively male. And to be young in the French Mandate period, at least as described by these groups, was sort of to be male or to fit the sort of masculine mold of what a young, strong, fit, but also sound of mind youth would be like. So that's largely how the organization starts and the types of young people that were in them. And then it sort of moves on from there. Now, some organizations are more diverse in terms of their makeup, in terms of where they pull individuals from, in terms of sect, region, et cetera, some less so. And that really varies group to group.
You made me think about something which you don't talk about much in the book, but it kind of like started buzzing me. Where did they get the money from? I mean, obviously, this organization needed some sort of income in order to survive. Did these young individuals pay the fee? There was money coming from outside sources?
Yeah. So there were membership fees. And for some organizations, they were actually fairly steep for the 1940s. I think, again, sort of reflecting that they thought their middle class members could pay this or had parents that could pay it. But beyond that, beyond what they drew from the organization, the leaders of these organizations would run fundraising throughout their communities for sure. Some of these leaders had more money or came from money. So Kamal Jumblat, the leader for the Progressive Socialist Party, which was always a political party or thought about as a social movement or political party, but with this concept of young people front and center, he had his own funds, right? So he was largely funding the organization and taking donations from Druze community members as well. One aspect I talk about in the first chapter is how these organizations pooled membership and funds from different parts of the world, from the Lebanese diaspora, students of Lebanon, the Arab world, Bilad al-Sham, more broadly speaking, will know that the Lebanese, Syrian Arabs from the Eastern Mediterranean more broadly were very diasporic people in the early 20th century, given what happens during the First World War and other factors. So these organizations pooled money from that as well. For example, an organization I focus on called the Vanguard Organization, which was a predominantly Shia organization, pooled rich donors from West Africa, Shia migrants who had went to West Africa to make fortunes there during actually sort of a economic boom in West Africa in the 1940s, and brought that money back. So largely that's where the money starts from, but also it sort of grows as the organization grows. The more membership they have, the more potential places they can pull money from.
Fascinating. I'm curious about, moving to chapter two, you talk about space and you make a very good point about the question of public sphere, something that is becoming central in many studies related to the history of the Middle East. Just recently, I interviewed for the network Bedros Dermatosyan on his new book about the massacres of Adana and how public sphere was central in order to develop this concept of violence. But you're also going a step forward and you talk about a specific space, which is the headquarters of the organization. And I was wondering if you can elaborate a little bit more about the role of the headquarters for the organizations and also for the politics of these people.
Yeah. So that chapter, I think, is where I get sort of the most theoretical. And I am talking about space, and it sounds like Bedros and myself have a similar sort of an understanding of sort of the role the public sphere plays in these organizations, but also how the state can use violence in the public sphere, these types of things. But in terms of the headquarters, I actually thought I'd pull from a particular page here. So in that second chapter, first of all, the headquarters, I talked first about how different organizations call their headquarters different things. One that is very interesting is that three of the organizations refer to their headquarters as the Beit, El Beit, the house, the home. This understanding of, was a means to replace the actual family of the youth with the family of the club and sanctify a space for that family. But other organizations use different terminology, Markaz, center, maqar, these different types of words. And what I write here is, regardless of the terminology, the headquarters was the space in which a host of events were held and spatial practices were performed. So the headquarters was a place first where young people would go to for a bevy of different events, not just lectures, political meetings, but sports parties, cultural events, dancing events, music events. So it became, for the organization, I argue, a place where the organization could cultivate both youth belonging, but also diversion and fun. You know, this concept largely coming about in the 20th century that your youth was to be a fun period, even if it was controlled. So a place of sort of fun and politics. But in terms of spatial practices, I think this is very interesting. Like spatially, where the headquarters is in the city, the routes that young people take to get to them, but also the types of things they do in them. For example, these sports parties, physical training, labels the headquarters as a space where you not only meet to think, but to act. And I think that becomes very important in the context of earlier sort of episodes of protests, popular mobilization, but also violence, where many people within the organization think of that space as sort of a launching pad for agitation of different sorts.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
That would require a sort of a different podcast just to keep talking about the importance of space and also the question of a headquarters. Unfortunately, we have to move forward, but I personally found it very, very interesting because it also relates to some elements of comparative history and to see how similar organizations developed in the Middle East around the same time and sort of a different understanding, but also very similar in many ways they had about this particular concept. But there's one thing, I don't want to say it's unique to Lebanon, but I think it's very important given the structure of the Lebanese state. So I was wondering, what was the relationship between these organizations and the Lebanese state?
Yeah, so it varies group to group, depending on their ideology, which I haven't talked much about ideology yet. I mean, some of these organizations are Lebanese nationalist, some are communist, some are Arab nationalist, some are different varieties of Lebanese nationalists. Sort of the official Christian nationalism was kind of sort of enshrined in the constitution of the country and things along those lines, the government of the country, and others more sort of like, okay, thinking of their group within the Lebanese state, for example, minorities like Shia minorities. So it depends in terms of its relationship to the state, if that ideology and if that version of populism is hostile to the state. So definitely in particular time periods, certain organizations were not only friends of the state, but like made up state government in terms of had some seats in parliament, things like that into the 1950s. But I do want to stress, because I think this is really important and something that's forgotten about particular organizations, is all seven of these organizations in different time periods were hostile to the state, clashed with the state, and actually were met by violence to the state, both the colonial state, but the early independent state as well. And I talk about this a lot in chapter two as well. Many of these organizations, they have what they refer to as their Mahmoudia Adem, their blood baptism. And different organizations talk about this. It's their origin story for their organization. And it often starts with actually a violent encounter with the state, whether security forces of the early independent state, that's the case with the Progressive Socialist Party, or colonial forces, French soldiers with the Kata'ib, for example. But these events of their relationship to the state and these violent encounters are really essential to the ways that they sort of see themselves. So although some groups would seem as more kind of friends of the Lebanese state and the official drivers of politics more so than others, I think generally speaking, it's important to remember that they were all hostile to the state, populist, and anti-state at certain aspects of their history.
I also want to ask something about membership, this time not in terms of fees. In your following chapter, you're talking about the fact that in order to win Lebanon, and I want to ask about this idea of winning Lebanon, but later.
Okay.
Men were not alone. They were not just obviously also the only category that these organizations should have tried to co-opt. And so I was wondering, how did these organizations try to broaden their base, both in terms of gender and geography?
Yeah, this was my favorite chapter to write. I love this chapter so much because I think it's something that is missed about these organizations when they're just referred to as sectarian, masculine, or ultranational, that their memberships, especially in the 1940s into 1950s, were quite broad. Because I think they realized, like your question sort of points out, that the city, the capital, was not enough. Like if they were actually going to be drivers of the country and win Lebanon, why not incorporate new types of people and incorporate new types of young people into the conception of what makes a youth organization a youth organization? So first, many of these organizations made overtures to working class young people, but also children as well. They had sort of philanthropy efforts to bring sort of children into the ranks of the organization. Also you mentioned gender and the aspect of women. This is extremely important. In all different shapes and forms, these organizations become more diverse. They are less male dominated, but become more, have more female membership and conceive the organizations do, and young people within them, as women as part of the drivers of the future, but also women sort of demanding and forcing that right. It's like if you're going to say that you are a organization that represents Lebanon, like where are we? Why aren't we here? So there's a big sort of conversation, a public conversation about that in the 40s and 50s. But all these organizations in different ways bring women in. Into the countryside as well. I mentioned working class and poor, but into different regions as well. You mentioned headquarters. Headquarters are fascinating. Branch offices are fascinating as well. And these organizations in all different ways set up branch offices in different parts of the country. and I'll explain one aspect of that later. The final, and I kind of mentioned this earlier with following the money and funding, is the diaspora. Many of these organizations create branches and create connections with the Lebanese diaspora, both in the Americas, later in Australia and Europe, but also Africa. And there's a section of this chapter where I kind of follow the Kitab and other organizations going to Africa. And I just learned recently that a group I actually didn't focus on too much in terms of its diasporic efforts, the Lebanese Communist Party, actually has pretty active branches in different parts of the world. So many of these organizations were diasporic and broadening the base that way. The diasporic youth were a part of what they saw as their organization. But I don't want to mislead here and act like this means that these organizations are 100% cosmopolitan, diverse, and perhaps quote unquote good drivers of change. Because, for example, where a organization puts a branch office in the country depends on where their membership is. And some of these organizations were predominantly either Christian or Shia Muslim or whatnot. So they set up their branches in parts of the country that reflect that. As it relates to women, in many cases, these organizations, yes, did bring women into it. But the idea, especially early, was to be a woman in this party was actually to act like a male, to be a part of the masculine nation. Or if women were to have quote unquote feminine features, whatever those might be, feminine interests, that those were separate from the political missions of the organization. So it's not always rosy in the sense of this incorporation, but the base does get broader, which I think is significant to not see these groups just as sectarian parties, but at the same time, contradictions do abound as they get bigger. How do they reconcile the fact that they are predominantly a Christian masculine party, for example, the Kataib, with the fact that they do get bigger, they do get more women, and they do become more regionally diverse?
Before talking about the last two chapters, which are very much focusing on 1958, actually, I wanted to ask you about this concept of sectarian identity. You make a point in the book saying that, well, their religious identity was important, but was not the main identity marker within the organization. And I was wondering if you can talk a little bit more about it, because often we have this idea looking at Lebanon that is obviously religiously divided, and that translates into the fact that every single group, organization, or even maybe sport club is then divided according to religious line. Mm-hmm. Was that the case?
It wasn't. So the majority of these organizations actually were quite diverse, and they were anti-sectarian from the start. So the Lebanese People's Party, the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, the Progressive Socialist Party to start, and the Arab Nationalist Youth, which is an organization I haven't brought up yet, were all very diverse sectarian in their membership. And this was actually a part of their populism, that they weren't just anti-state and anti-elite, they were anti-sectarian. So I think that's very important. But there are three organizations, the Kataib, the Nejade, and the Vanguard organization, Talaa, had sectarian membership. So how did they make sense? They make sense of this? All of their versions of Lebanese nationalism saw their sect as sort of building up what made a diverse cosmopolitan Lebanon. That's how they talked about it, at least. In their pamphlets, for example, the Kataib party will be talking about a Lebanese nationalism that brings all groups together while maintaining the rights of minority Christians. Shia in Lebanon through the Vanguard organization, they talk about, why can't Shia are so marginalized? Why can't we be a part of this national ethos? And in many ways, they might not have been anti-sectarian, but they don't talk about sectarian identity that much. And I think that's important. You can make an argument that's assumed because they know their membership, but it wasn't central to the construction of their identity. What was more important were these concepts of youth, that they were young, driving the future, middle-class identity, belonging, these types of things. So you don't, for example, in many of the membership cards for organizations like that, they don't ask their members what sect they are. And many of these organizations did have minorities that were either, you know, different from the main majority. Again, I think it's fair to say you're not asking them their sect because you already know it. But the fact that they don't ask it themselves, I think, is an important historical observation, that they don't see it as essential to projecting their identity.
I'm pretty sure that you will run into some criticism about this. Maybe some scholars, perhaps mostly, you know, from a different generation, would criticize your views about the use of sectarianism. But I want to move into the question of 1958. Can you give us a sense, a little bit, perhaps a little bit of a context about how the Civil War came to be? And what was the role, the initial role of the organizations within the context of a civil war?
Yeah. So this war in 1958, it's often talked about. If we look at articles by, for example, Fawaz Jurjiz, who wrote a great article on 1958, it's often thought about what were the internal factors, what were the external factors. And internally, it largely dealt with politics and official politics. Like I said, at this point by 1958, these organizations were largely a part of the political system. So when there's a particular electoral law that is brought on by President Camille Chamoun in, I think, 1956, some organizations are upset about this gerrymandering because they think it's going to hurt their ability to participate in politics. So there's protests in Lebanon leading up from 1956, 1957, when the parliamentary elections are, all the way to 1958. And these organizations are the forefront of those protests. On the other side is the external factors. We know this is the early Cold War period, you know, which I talk about in the book, and how these groups were divided on a simple question: are you Nasserist or not? Do you actually do you follow Gamal Abdel Nasser, the ideology of Arab nationalism, or are you afraid that that is going to hurt Lebanon? And that really divided the country, but also divided these organizations as well in very interesting ways. So the spark of there were already protests. There was already sort of anger at President Camille Chamoun, given his gerrymandering. And the thought was that he was going to try and pack the parliament with loyalists so he could change the constitution to give him another term as president. So many people were angered about that aspect. But actually, the actual spark was in May 1958, when a journalist, an anti-Chamoun journalist, Nasib Mutni, was assassinated, was killed on the streets of Beirut. And most of the organizations came out immediately and said, this is awful. But what happened from there is what really starts to divide these organizations.
You mentioned, obviously, the agency of President Chamoun, which was he was at the center of a 1958 conflict, we may say. And so I was wondering, how did the various organizations react to those events? And also, how did the sectarian identity click? I mean, the sense from your book is that at some point, from this, let's say, anti-sectarian attitude, we see a switch where sectarian identity became important.
Yes, absolutely. And it does become really important in this moment. So in 1958, the mass majority of the groups were sort of against this gerrymandering and were against Chamoun. But very interestingly the Kataib, which, you know, you can make the argument they were the most sectarian of these organizations, even if they espoused anti-sectarianism. They did not like Camille Chamoun. They did not like him through the 1950s up until 1958. They actually didn't very much support him. But what happened as the conflict started, and this was the big dividing point, some organizations were very afraid that they're either privilege within the Lebanese system, or Lebanon as an independent country, was going to be swallowed up by the United Arab Republic. And the two organizations that end up siding with President Kamel Shimon, actually pretty late, and I make this point in the book, and I think it's a very important point, the Kitab did not join alongside Kamel Shimon and the government until it was clear that the United Nations was not going to intervene to save Lebanon, because this was an issue that Kamel Shimon brought to the United Nations. The United Arab Republic is intervening in our country. When the UN report came back that basically said this is an internal issue, we're not going to do anything, that is when the Kitab really moved towards President Shimon. I think that's important. It's not to say that the organization wasn't sectarian, but in that moment, they weren't immediately, like you used the phrase, clicked by sectarianism. That's something that actually grew out from this event. The Syrian Social Nationalist Party was very, very interesting. Their organization actually that was never very much aligned with the government, the state, Shimon, or the Kitab, align with these forces at this point. And the argument is made, and I make the argument as well, is that they were very anti-Nasserist. They saw Nasserism as sort of something that was trying to co-opt Syrian nationalism, and they weren't for that. So that was the reason they joined along with Shimon. All the others believed that Shimon's dealings were predominantly affecting their organizations, but also they were either definitely pro-Nasserist. Not all of them were for the creation of, say, United Arab Republic that would include Lebanon, but some, like, say, the Lebanese Communist Party, weren't specifically Nasserist. Let's remember that Nasser, didn't really like communists that much. But they saw sort of and this is what I talk about, I think I call that phrase, like, riding the revolutionary wave. They see that sort of that version of populism at that point that is gaining traction is at least okay with Nasserism. So the Lebanese Communist Party does sort of come over to that side as well and against the state.
There's one particular organization, a group, that you talk about, and it looks like was marginalized during the conflict, and that's the Shia. And I was wondering if you can speak about them a little bit more.
Yeah, so definitely so. There is very, very literature on the role that the Shia played and Shia notables played in 1958. And one of the source issues here is that the only organization that did not have a newspaper that I can follow to the 1950s is the Vanguard organization, Talai, this organization, which was predominantly Shia. So unfortunately, I can't follow Shia youth and their actions and participation in the 1958 war in the way that I can do for other demographics or organizations, which of course is not something that I'm particularly fond of, but you know, we're bound by our sources as historians. But what I can do, and I do in the chapter, is talk about the leaders of those organizations and sort of how their roles played out in the conflict. So one individual I follow, his name is Rashid Beydoun. He was the founder of the Vanguard organization. And he was actually, he had a seat in parliament under these new 1957 elections. So he didn't particularly think the elections were rigged because they gave him a seat. But he was the defense minister of Lebanon in 1950, and I write about this a little bit in the sense that he actually resigns from the position because he thinks that this insurrection has become too big, and he doesn't think he can actually help defend the country, so he resigns from that position. So in a position of power to start, but marginal towards the end. You also have Kamal Mrue, who was a... he was another founder of the Vanguard organization. He had the newspaper El Hayat at the time. And he was, like the Syrian Social Nationalist Party, was extremely anti-Nasserist. So in that way, he he didn't support the government, he didn't support Shamoun, but was almost backed into a corner because the power and momentum of Nasserism, he was not for country for the country, for Lebanon. But yeah, generally speaking, they played a role. I try and write that role in terms of these leaders. But yes, organizationally speaking, as the sources aren't there, I can't follow them as closely as I'd like.
Moving towards the end of the book, I was fascinated by the fact that you talk about how 1958 is remembered. And so I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit more about it, but also if you can tell us, why is it important to look at how that particular event has been memorialized in time? And secondly, just as a spin-off, I wanted to ask you about what happened to that youth, what happened to those individuals that were young in 1958?
Yeah, absolutely. So first off, in terms of this, how we, in terms of how 1958 is remembered or not remembered, I wanted to start with the fact this is a conflict that lasted from basically March 1958 to October 1958. The country was in full insurrection. I mean, there were parts of the country that were calling for secession. It 4,000 individuals perished during this conflict. U.S. Marines intervened. Given the issues with the United Arab Republic, Kamel Shamoun deported hundreds and thousands of Syrians and Palestinians that were living in Lebanon at this time. So, it is a conflict that I don't see as a blip, only if you see it in comparison to 1975 to 1990. But in and of itself, it was a very significant event, but it is not remembered given the war that happens thereafter. It's seen as maybe a prelude to the civil war of 1975 to 1990, a war that was unresolved, but always sort of spoken about in the specter of 1975 to 1990. And that's another reason that I believed and still do that it was important to kind of end this book and focus on 1958 in its own right, to give it its own sort of interpretation without the specter of the Lebanese Civil War thereafter. Other reasons that I sort of culminate and focus on 1958 is this was a revolutionary time period. Early Cold War period, you have revolutions in Cuba, Algeria, Lebanon, and many of the young people that were a part of these organizations who were anti-government saw themselves as part of a bigger nationalist, potentially leftist constellation of revolution. So I think it's another reason to end in 1958. I feel like Lebanon is often seen as sort of exceptional, its own thing, separate. In the end, this book is about Lebanon, but I do like sort of drawing the connections between the broader context. In terms of what happens to these young people, I thought I would read again really quickly because in terms of what happens to these young people. So some of these names are actually, become household names. Bashir and Amin Jamal, for example, Walid Jumblatt, the son of Kamal Jumblatt, George Howie, who becomes the founder of the Lebanese Communist Party. All of these individuals played a role in 1958. They participated and they talk about it. And this is what Samir Khalif calls their initiation into militancy. And then this is where I write here. At 20 years or younger, they participated alongside their fathers, brothers, and sisters in these rituals of violence, their blood baptism, so to speak. Furthermore, the type of language they practiced to make sense of the conflict, our just struggles versus the punks and their abomination, and how they performed their violence, rituals of youth culture, and where they engaged in conflict is observable in future moments of sectarian violence in Lebanon and beyond during the 20th and 21st centuries. So to summarize there, that it was many of them, their initiation into what they would do to win Lebanon, like how they would fight to sort of win Lebanon in the image of their organization. But also many of the traits of this conflict in 1958, and this is another reason I think 1958 is so important, that they sort of breathed out into life, become ways that we can understand the later Civil War and themes and ideas and concepts that come up in the later Civil War, whether how it was lived or how it's talked about thereafter.
So in the end, I must ask, was Lebanon won?
I love that question, I get it a lot. Obviously there's the Jaron Forn of winning to kind of keep it open. In ways it was by certain organizations. So sometimes people, I refer to a group like the Kataeb as non-elite and sort of popular, and they're like, Dylan, this is a household name. Well, this book is the story by which they become a household name. They did sort of win Lebanon in their image, at least up until the Lebanese Civil War. The Progressive Socialist Party is in the mix up until today. The Kataeb, they're now both oppositional parties in the parliament, and they both have seats in parliament. But they won a part of Lebanon, a section of Lebanon, if you will. So in some ways, some organizations did, others didn't. For example, some of these organizations don't even exist anymore. The Nejade organization, the Arab Nationalist Youth Organization. But in other ways, they didn't. And I think this is one of the conundrums that I'm working through in this book. These organizations are getting bigger. They're claiming that they represent the bigger national politique, but in the end, do they really? Or are they, or do they have certain types of membership bases, whether male, whether sectarian, that they fall under? So I think part of it is that yes, certain agents within in the country of Lebanon successfully won portions of it and changed the country accordingly. Others were sort of subsumed by the structure of sectarianism the story we all know too well. So it's mixed as most historical records are.
One last question. Is there anything that we didn't talk about, but you feel you want to mention about your book?
I don't particularly think about, I don't think so, but I guess one thing is the sports parties. I think that we didn't talk about that too much, but we talked about it a little bit with the headquarters, and you said you were interested in this phenomenon a little bit more. When we think about parties, not political parties, but gatherings, we think of concerts, we might think of music festivals. These organizations had parties where sports were played and thousands of individuals came to them. And I think it's something that we like, and they literally called them haflat riyadiyah, sports parties for sport. And this is something, I mean, obviously we do have with the professionalization of sports, we have national sports events, we have big stadiums, etc. But that what we think about as a political party would have these large parties dedicated to youth sports, I think is very interesting. And I think it also, again, helps us complicate a little bit more this concept of the political party. These organizations aren't just political parties. And I think something like a sports party or just a dedication of a day to different sporting events, whether ping pong, wrestling, basketball, really helps us kind of understand these organizations as more diverse and not just sectarian political parties.
This was Dylan Baum, author of Winning Lebanon, Youth Politics, Populism, and the Production of Sectarian Violence, 1920 to 1958, published by Cambridge University Press, and with an upcoming paperback edition in October. Dylan, thank you so much.
Thank you, Roberto.